All right. Good morning. We are somewhere around the second chapter of Romans. Romans 1:18 to 3:20 is talking about how and why a person is lost. Regardless of where you live, when you live there, all men are under what? Law. Jews are under law of Moses. Gentiles under moral law, law of the conscience, however you want to say it. Are they related? Are those two laws related? How? You got to write an essay on it in one sentence. What is the compare moral law to the law of Moses? Both are centered around the Ten Commandments. One was written. One came, is transmitted how? When you're born, right? Written on your heart. When did that start? Garden of Eden, right? What was the name of the tree that God told them not to eat of? Tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when they ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what was the consequence or the result? They had knowledge of good and evil, right? And every person since then has had an innate awareness of right and wrong. The Ten Commandments are eternal truth principles. They didn't become wrong to kill, steal, commit adultery in Exodus 20 on Mount Sinai. It already was. So it's not true because it's in the law of Moses or in the Ten Commandments. It's in the Ten Commandments because it's true. It always has been true. It still is true. In fact, Jesus will even intensify the understanding of that in the Sermon on the Mount, won't he? He said, you've heard it said by them of old times, thou shalt not kill, but I say to you what? I got more meaning in that than I want you to understand. I don't want you to hate your brother. It goes deeper than the outward, external act. It goes into your heart. Righteousness is from the inside out. It's not just a matter of the outside. What you think counts. You ever hit your thumb with a hammer and you didn't say it, but you thought it? You know, and you said, boy, I hope what you think don't count. Well, it does. It does. We're talking in Romans 1:18 to 3:20 about how a person tries to be righteous by keeping law. Everybody is under law, regardless of when or where they lived. Everybody is under God-given law, not just some arbitrary law. It doesn't matter where they live. It doesn't matter when they live. And we've talked about these Ten Commandments as if they were bar graphs. Everybody has an awareness of right and wrong about killing. It's not the same. Everybody doesn't draw their line at the same place. About stealing, everybody doesn't draw their line at the same place. We're not, at this point, talking about where the line should be drawn. We're talking about where it is drawn. Every single person, like fingerprints, has this bar graph of what you believe to be right and wrong. And the reality is, every single one of us have done what we know to be wrong. Have you ever told somebody it's wrong to do something and turn around and done that very same thing yourself? And every one of us are guilty, right? And so here's our guy under law. Never had a chance to hear about the gospel. He stands before God to be judged. He never had a Bible. He never knew about Jesus Christ or the cross. How's God going to judge him? God will take the standard by which he lived, and he'll convict him of sin about which he is aware. And he is going to say, and every mouth will be stopped, and the whole world become guilty before God. Now, The consequence of living under law and trying to be justified by law, we're going to see here, and he's going to draw it to a head. But just to make sure that we're all together, in Romans chapter 2, three principles of judgment that God will use on the law keeper. And everybody's under law. The first one is in chapter 2, verse 1. You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For at what point you judge the other, you're condemning yourself because you who pass judgment do the same things. So here this lawkeeper is. He's never heard about Jesus or the Christ or the cross or the church or baptism or any of those things. Stands before God, and God asks him the simple question. Have you ever told somebody's wrong to do something and turned around and done that very same thing yourself? And the answer is what? Guilty. We're all guilty. And so that says that we were aware of a standard of right and wrong, doesn't it? And it also says that we have chosen to do what we knew was wrong. And so what's the gospel got to do with this? Nothing. If Jesus Christ had never come to this earth, would man be lost or would he be saved? If he'd be saved, what are you saying about the cross? He died for nothing. That's exactly what Paul wrote in Galatians. If we could have been justified by law, then verily Christ died for nothing, he said. And so that's where, but the man who's out here under law, and it's all he ever knows, he doesn't have an alternative to that, does he? And so here he is standing before God to be judged, and the first question is, have you ever done anything that you told somebody else was wrong? And I call that self-judgments. Three principles of judgment on the lawkeeper. Romans 2. The first one is self-judgment. Second one is in verse 13 and 14, and I call that all men have God-given law. For it is not those, well, verse 12 says, all who sin apart from the law will perish apart from the law. All who sin under the law will be judged by the law. And then he begins a parenthetical expression by explanation. For it is not those who hear the law that are righteous in God's sight, but those who obey the law will be declared righteous. And then, just in case you don't know who has law and who doesn't, he says, indeed, the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law. They become a law unto themselves, even though they don't have the law. And so the Gentiles do innately, naturally, instinctively, different versions use different words, the things that are in the law of Moses. And that's what we've talked about. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, etc. Now, does everybody believe exactly the same about all those things? No. But does everybody have a belief about those things? Yes. What affects where you draw your line of what you believe to be right and wrong? What your mama told you? What your teachers told you? What society tells you? All those things affect. Then when you come across God's Word, as we as Christians, we begin a new journey. And our life is, one pretty good way to look at our life as Christians is, we're trying to hit that level of right and wrong by letting God tell us what's right and wrong. We want to draw our line about adultery and lying and murder. We want to draw it where God draws it. And by the way, as we study His Word, we're still tweaking that. Aren't we? Is what you believe, your faith system right now, is it the same as it was 10 years ago? Or is it changed some? Well, if you're studying God's Word, it's going to change some if you're applying it. Because you're not right up square on target on all of them, I can tell you, in case you don't know, because nobody's ever told you that before. You're not right square on target on all of it. And you are adjusting. You think it's possible, just a discussion question, you think it's certainly possible to draw your standard of right and wrong too low, right? We'll all agree on that, right? Got lots of folks that would illustrate that. You think it's possible to draw it too high? You think it's possible to expect more of yourself than God expects of you? You think? I think it probably is. I think there are some people who have set for themselves impossible standards that you can't ever reach, and you'll never be able to reach. And you won't forgive yourself. I had a lady that came, she was a middle-aged lady, been a Christian all her life, came into my office one day and was just, and you'll think this is crazy, but she was just heartbroken because she had run a yellow light. And she sat in my office and she cried and she cried and she cried because she had run a yellow light. And she was dead serious. And she didn't know if God, you know, it was just that impulsive thing, and she hit the accelerator and went through it while it was still yellow. And when she did it, she couldn't undid it. And it was bothering her conscience, and she had to come talk to me about it. And you think she might have had a standard that might have been a little high? Boy, that's going to be hard to live with, isn't it? I mean, if that's the way, if that's where your standard is all the way, that's going to be hard. Now, you know, it's not all a bad thing that she had a sensitive conscience. But boy, that conscience operates at that level where you draw your line. And there are some people that can do something and your conscience doesn't bother you, and other people do that same thing and your conscience bothers you. Paul will talk about that very specific thing in 1 Corinthians. And if you do something that your conscience bothers you about, why does your conscience bother you? What does that say? That you have done what you knew was wrong, what you believed to be wrong, right? Otherwise, you don't even know you got a conscience till you do something that you believe to be wrong, and then your conscience starts operating. And so, the third point here, the third principle of judgment in this context, and I did not say these words, I started out last time and didn't say them, is the testimony of the conscience. He says in verse 15, they show the requirements of the law written on their hearts. These Gentiles who do not have the law but do by nature the things contained in the law. They show the requirements of the law written on their heart. Who wrote them there? Who wrote the requirements of the law on their heart? God did, right? And so their conscience also bearing witness. Bearing witness to what? That they have an awareness of right and wrong. The fact that you have a conscience doesn't say where you draw that line of right and wrong, but it says that you do draw a line of right and wrong. The fact that you have a conscience. Does everybody have a conscience? Yes, everybody has a conscience. Does everybody's conscience function properly? No. Why? Because you ignore it long enough and you sear it over as with a hot iron. Any of you ever burned yourself deep enough that you could stick a pin in that skin that came back and you can't feel it? That's one of the interesting things about having been severely burned. That particular spot of tissue, of flesh, has no nerve endings. You burned them out. They died. And so it's like a callus. You can stick a pin in it, and there's no feeling there. There's no sensitivity. And there are people who have abused their conscience by ignoring it so long that it doesn't operate properly anymore. Is that God's fault, by the way? That's not God's fault. It's not God's fault. So, three principles on judgment of the man without Christ, the man under law. Here's a man trying to be righteous under law. God takes his conscience out and he puts it on the stand, judgment, and he says, has Ken Stegall ever done anything that you told him not to do? And my conscience is going to say, yes, many times he has. So we're seeing how God's going to judge this person who never had the gospel. Now, the result, and look, he says in verse 16, that will take place on the day when God will judge men's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. So, this is the judgment on the lawkeeper. And all of this time, the Jew has been saying, I like this guy, Paul. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Jew has. He says, I like what he's saying here, these people that he's writing to. But now, I mean, he's been talking all this time about the Gentile and, you know, how they depart from God and all this. Now, verse 17, he turns around to the audience that's been sitting in the gallery up to this point, and he says, and now you call yourself a Jew. And you rely on the law. You brag about your relationship to God, that you know as well, and you approve of what's superior because you're instructed by the law. You're convinced that you're a guide for the blind, a light for those in darkness, an instructor to the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth. You who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? And they would say what? Of course not. But the answer was what? Yes, you do. You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Are you crazy? But what's the answer? If a man looks upon a woman and lusts after in his heart, you who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? Boy, this would be an atrocity to these people. This is an incredible insult to these people. As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Now, how do you think the Jews feel all of a sudden? He's been saying to Paul, go get them, buddy. You know, stick it to them. Amen. Preach on. And then he turns around and says, and you, you're called a Jew. And you have all of these things that you take your pride in. He says, let me tell you something. These Gentiles out here, they don't want anything to do with Christianity because of you. They don't want anything to do with God because of you, because they look at you and they see the hypocrisy in you. And they don't want anything to do with God and your religion. Circumcision is a value, has value if you observe the law. But if you break the law, you become as though you had not been circumcised. If those who are not circumcised keep the law's requirement, will they not be regarded as though they were circumcised? He's saying these Gentiles, they're doing better than you are out here. And you think it's a big deal because you've been circumcised. But these Gentiles who have not been circumcised, if they keep the law, they're closer to God than you are. The one who is not circumcised physically and yet obeys the law will be condemned, will condemn you who, even though you have the written code in circumcision, are the lawbreaker. What's he saying? These Gentiles are better than you are. They're closer to God than you are. These Gentiles that you consider so unclean and so ungodly, they're closer to God than you are. A man is not a Jew if he is one outwardly only, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit. Not by the written code. Such a man's praise is not from men, but from God. And so now he got the Gentile in chapter 1:18 up here to chapter 2, verse 16. Then he turned and he said, you've been sitting here enjoying this all this time, haven't you? Let me tell you something. Everything I've said about the Gentiles, you're worse than they are. And so now the Jews has got his back up. And this has really got under his skin. And so he's got some questions. And chapter 3 begins with 1, 2, 3, 4. There's four questions. You can outline this section really easily. There's four questions and four answers. First question is in verse 1, if you want to outline this. Second one is in verse 3. The third one's in verse 5, and the fourth one's in verse 9. And so the question is in 1, 3, 5, and 9. And in between that is the answer. So the first question now he has talked to the Gentile, now he's addressed the Jew. And so the Jew is asking some questions now, because this has rocked their world. What advantage then is there in being a Jew, or what value is there in circumcision? If all of this that you say is true, that the Gentiles blaspheme the name of God because of the way that we Jews are acting, then what advantage has there been in being a Jew? And you're going to think that Paul would say none. That would be what you would think the flow of this question and answer would go. But that's not what he says. He says there's much in every way. There are lots of advantages to being a Jew, primarily because they've been entrusted with the very words of God. Did they get a special revelation from God, the Jews? Mount Sinai, Exodus 20? Yeah. And not only that, but they continued to get this law. And the law contains 613 specific commandments. Thou shalt and thou shalt not. 365 said, thou shalt not do so-and-so. And 248 said, thou shalt do so-and-so. So they got a whole bunch of them. Now, you think you got a checklist. How would you like to have that checklist? How would you like to every day have to check through 613? Yes, 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 no, 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 no. How would you like to do that? So, is there been any advantage in being a Jew then? Yeah, he said. You got special revelation from God. There have been lots of advantages. Secondly, what if some did not have faith? Now, that's not the question. That sets up the question. Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? That's the question. Okay, you said that there were lots of Jews who were not faithful. Then does that mean that God, they didn't live up to their part of this contract with God? And so does that release God from his part? Does that mean because they weren't faithful, does that mean God's not going to be faithful to his part of the promise? Did their unfaithfulness release God from his promises? And the answer is what? No. God is going to be faithful to his part if every person in the world is a liar. Now, there are some promises that God made that were conditional, and there were some that were unconditional. There were some that he said, I will do so-and-so if you will do so-and-so. And there were others that he said, I will do so-and-so. And you can get in on it if you do this, but I'm going to do this. And so there are promises that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. One of the promises that God made to Abraham is through his seed, all nations of the earth were going to be blessed. And Galatians chapter 3, verse 16 says that seed is Christ. And so he overlooked lots of things in the Jews' history and their disbelief and their lack of faith for generations and generations and generations. And he still remained faithful to that promise that he gave to Abraham in Genesis 12, didn't he? He brought Christ, the Messiah, into this world a long time after he made that promise to Abraham. And he was faithful to that promise, even though the Jews were not faithful. And so that needs to be asked. And then the third question, but if our righteousness brings out God's righteousness, now we're getting a little bolder here, okay? You get some really fundamental questions asked and answered, and then you get out here to the ones that's really on your mind. If our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That's not the end of the question yet. Here's the question. That God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us. Now, somebody rephrase that question in simpler terms. Read it again. If our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, is God unjust to punish us? So, what are they saying?
Aren't I doing God a favor by acting unrighteously?
Yeah.
So that he can see, demonstrate his righteousness?
Do you understand that the darker the environment, the more obvious a candle is in that environment? If you were to walk in here with a candle, you know, most people would look at it. If this was a completely sealed off room that was totally dark and somebody walked in with a candle, every single eye would instantly go to it. Every eye in the room. to go to that light. And so he's saying, you know, you're saying that God is righteous and we're unrighteous. And so I actually, when God is merciful to us because of our unrighteousness, it makes God look good. And so we're doing God a favor, as Eric said. We're doing God a favor when we do something wrong, because then God really looks good. Yes, sir.
I think Paul himself actually rephrased it when he said, shall we go on sinning so that God's grace may abound?
In Romans 6, that's right. He'll rephrase that and readdress that concept just a little bit later. That's right. But look at what Paul has to throw in here. What's that in parentheses? What does he say? I'm using a human argument. He wants you to know that, okay? He says, this is not what I'm saying. I'm saying this on behalf of some other people that I know are thinking that. And I want you to know that I'm not saying this. It's not an argument I use. And you think, nobody would reason that way. Are you sure? Are you sure that we never quite reason that way? Maybe not all the way to the fence like this, but we have some of this, you know, that some of this in us. He says, is God unjust in bringing His wrath on us? That's the question. Based on this premise that I'm doing God a favor by doing wrong. Because God really, it shows God to be really righteous when I'm unrighteous, in stark contrast to me. And so, if there weren't all this unrighteousness, you wouldn't know how righteous God is. And so, I'm doing a good thing when I'm unrighteous because it shows how righteous God is. And so, God shouldn't punish me then. Now, is that a convoluted argument? Is that some twisted logic? But hey, we do some of that ourselves sometimes. He says, certainly not. If that were so, then how could God judge the world? He couldn't. Because the worst sinner is doing him, the worse you sin, the more favor you're doing him, if this reasoning is correct. Someone might argue, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases His glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? That's just a rephrasing of what he just said, right? Why not say, as we're being slanderously reported, and some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may result? Why don't we just live by that principle? Let's just get out here and sin with both hands, and it makes God look better all the time. And the worse sinner you are, the better God looks, and the better friend you are to God. Boy, isn't that interesting human logic? Their condemnation is deserved. Who? People who reason with this kind of logic. They know better. But they'll still use that argument. And so question number 4. What shall we conclude then? Aren't we any better than the Gentile? Now, he started out, is there any advantage in being a Jew? Oh yeah, lots of advantages. Now he asks the question, aren't we any better? This is an incredulous question. It has never, ever entered a Jew's mind to ask this question until Paul has laid this out. Until he showed how unrighteous and ungodly the Gentiles were, and then he turned around and said to the Jews, and you're worse. You're worse than they are. And I mean, they're just here with their mouth open. No Jew has ever said that to other Jews. And so they say incredulously, aren't we any better? And what's his answer? You got it. You're no better. You are no better. Now, he starts his conclusion right here, this whole section. Not at all. We already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin, as it is written. And now he goes to, what, 1, 2, 3 different Psalms? And he starts quoting, and he puts several quotations together. And from verse 10 through 18 is quotation from the Old Testament to show that this has always been the case. It's always been said, there is no one righteous, not even one. Now, folks, We've got to understand that. This is a conclusion of what he's been saying up to this point. It's already been written. There is none righteous, not one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who searches for God. All have turned away and together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. So who would that include? You can all raise our hands. It would include me. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. Notice the different body parts he uses. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their paths. A way of peace do they not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. So he's quoted from the Old Testament and said, hey, this shouldn't be a shock to you. It's been here all along for you to understand. But sometimes, in our self-righteousness, we have to have somebody take our nose and rub it in the reality, don't we? Before we can understand. Because we'll deny it. After all, I'm a pretty good guy. If you don't believe it, just ask me. Right? I mean, I don't understand why in the world everybody wouldn't love me. I don't understand why God wouldn't love me. Until I look at God. And God's not like me. God's righteous. And in Him, there is not even a hint of a shadow of unrighteousness. And He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And He does not change. And He's perfectly righteous. And He's so righteous that a person who sinned one time, that there won't be one single sin in heaven. Not one. And there won't be a sinner in heaven. And so all I know out here in this world is law. And so I want to go to heaven. I want to be good, and I try to be good. But I'm not very good. And so my alternative is I look around me and I find people who are not as good as I think I am, and so I measure myself by them and I try to make myself feel good about myself. And that gets to be a mess. And we even do that sometimes in a church. People under law do that. We do it out of desperation. Because I'm not going to measure myself by somebody I think is doing better than I am. I'm going to pick somebody that ought to be doing better. I'm going to pick the preacher's kids. They ought to be doing better than me. They ought to be doing better than me, so I measure myself by them, and everything they do wrong, I'm going to make sure that everybody knows about it. Isn't that interesting? Or the elders' kids. Or whoever. And so we pick someone and we judge ourselves by them, and we do it to make ourselves feel better. You see, there's two ways under law you can be righteous. You can either keep it perfectly and be righteous. That's pretty tough. Or either you can judge yourself by other people and make yourself feel better by thinking you're doing better than most, because after all, God's going to grade on the curve, isn't He? And the top 10% is going to get in, right? Now, we have never said that, but it's back there somewhere. I mean, He's going to put my good and my bad, and I've got a lot more good than bad, you know. And that's all the world's got if you live under law. But the problem is, if there's one bad, it outweighs all the good. Just one. If a man keeps a whole law and offends at one point, he's guilty of what? Of transgressing it all. And so you're no better. Isn't that what he's saying right here? There is none righteous, not even one. Verse 19. We're wrapping her up in this section right here. Do you have something to say, Eric?
I was going to say just in religion, I'm not going to say Christianity, but in religion, don't we as often do this? Like we require, if you're going to indict me for something that I did, whether it's in society or even in the church, oftentimes, don't we say you have to show me book, chapter, verse,
yeah,
instance? And that's what Paul did here, because he had to for the Jewish people. Otherwise, there's no other way to reason it.
Yeah, he's talking to people under law, right?
But sometimes we're as bad or worse
And see, part of our problem, and maybe a way to say that one of our biggest problems in the Lord's church is we bring a law mentality with us. And we try to blend a law and a grace system. But we'll talk about that some more coming up. Right now, we're talking about a person who lives under law. And he's trying to be justified by law. And look at verse 19. Now, boy, here's the punchlines. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. If you have a King James Version, it says the whole world become guilty before God. We know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under law. What law? Any law. The law that we live under. So that every mouth will be silenced. What do you suspect that might mean? When you stand before God as a law keeper, He'll take the standard that you live by, He will judge you by it, and He will convict you of sin about which you have no excuse. You have sinned, and you know you've sinned. And He will convict you of that sin that you know about. There will be no but. He'll stop it all. Every mouth will be silenced. You know what but means, right? I know I'm guilty, but there won't be any. It'll be, I know I'm guilty. And that's the end of it. Every mouth will be silenced. And the whole world stand guilty before God. Now, folks, I've got to get all your hope. If you hold out any hope that you're going to stand before God under law and be saved, we haven't done our job here yet. I've got to get it all. So that you get to the point that you understand if you stand before God and you're judged by the law that you lived under and you keep law, you're a law keeper, you're trying to be righteous by law, you don't have any hope. None. I take a big breath here because that's hard. Look at verse 20. Conclusion. Therefore. That means because of everything he said before, that's gone before here. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing, and you can take the word "the" out because it's not in the text, by observing law. You see, part of our problem in studying Romans and Galatians particularly is that we've always made all of this apply only to the Jew, and we never applied it to us. And part of the reason that we did is because it says "the." And when it says the law, it's only talking about the law of Moses. And so it's never really meant anything to me. But whatever, even when he's talking about the law of Moses, is still true of any law that a person would use to justify himself. So here's the conclusion of the whole matter up to this point. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing law. That's it, folks. And if you're living out here in the world and you never heard of Christ and the cross and church and baptism and the Lord's Supper and all the things associated with Christianity, what alternative do you have? You don't. It's law. And isn't it interesting that even people who claim to believe in grace want to go back under law? Well, we could stop right here. And we'll go hit a few verses. I'm pretty committed to staying in the text as we go through Romans. But the book of Galatians really fits here, folks. It really fits here. Because he's going to say, you who are trying to be justified by law, you're ignoring the righteousness that God makes available to you. Because there's two ways to be righteous. You can keep law, but there's a curse associated with it. What is it? Cursed is he that continueth not in everything written in the book of the law to do it. And so you got to do it all. You got to do it all right every time, all the time. You can't ever make one single mistake. But that's the way that most people in the world are trying to be righteous. Those who are concerned about being righteous. They're trying to keep a law. And boy, we could stop right here and we could talk about, as I said in my sermon this morning, you could talk about some major world religions right here. Because all they got is a law. They don't have a Savior. And consequently, there is no mercy and there's no grace. I like mercy. And I like grace. And if I like it, I better give some of it. You know what I'm saying? I better give some if I want some. And it really is easy and very conscientious, good salt of the earth people. Their whole religion is based on keeping this law, and they feel righteous because they say, I don't do this, and 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 look at all these other people that do it. And there's mindsets about being righteous. And there are lots of good religious people that say, I am righteous, I'm going to heaven because I don't do this and this and this and this, and because I do this and this and this and this. And that's the basis of their hope. And it's been ingrained in a lot of us. And it's hard to get out. And when somebody first starts giving you what they say is a biblical alternative to that, it scares you. Because I'll tell you this, it'll get to a point when, and we're fixing, this has all been bad news up to this point. I get tired of bad news. But when we get to the good news is better than the bad news is bad. And you're going to think, if you're coming out of this law-keeping mentality, you're going to think, this can't be right because it's too good to be true. I've been there, I know. But it is true. The gospel is incredibly good news. We've just made it a little better than law. Maybe I have a chance. Maybe if I get in line behind Paul and God's in a really good mood, he'll, forget and leave the door open and I'll get slip into heaven. Or I get my sins forgiven from prayer to prayer. Lord, forgive me since I last stood justified in your sight. What is that? What is that? Are we forgiven from prayer to prayer? What if I die in between prayers and I get sideswiped, I get blindsided by a train and just killed and I didn't get to pray just before I died? Then I guess I don't have any hope. It's better than that, folks. It's better than that. And we'll see it, but we've got to get to this point. Rather, through law, we become conscious of sin. Who's lost? I'm lost. What can I do about it? Not one blessed thing. And I have no hope. But there's good news coming.